What's up, interpreters? I'm Jeff Landon, and I have the dubious honor of having created the mascot for the Durham Bulls baseball club, Wool E. Bull. That's Wool Education Bull.
What's up, interpreters? I am NAI Executive Director Paul Caputo, and I just learned a thing. Does E for Wool E. Bull, does it stand for education?
Yes, we had a naming contest, and the gentleman who won the contest also won season tickets for life.
Whoa.
And he decided that E stood for education. Even more appropriate that we are talking about this now. But Song, you haven't introduced yourself yet.
Well, hey, what's up, interpreters? I'm Song. I'm your events manager with NAI, and we are very excited to be speaking today. And by the way, everybody, I just want to make it clear that this was not a Paul's Choice podcast guest.
it's very clear that I have a reputation of being something of a baseball fan and an enthusiast for the sport, in particular minor league baseball. This idea was presented to me by Song. Song came to me with this idea. But I am thrilled to be speaking with the creator of the mascot who got hit in the head by Nuke LaLoosh in Bull Durham.
Realize that the movie predated the mascot.
Is the mascot from the real life mascot? Is it based on the movie mascot, or are they totally different?
We decided we needed a mascot because of the movie.
Okay.
No kidding.
And okay. Yeah, they had the scene where, you know, hit the bull, and Luke LaLoosh did, and that was in 1988.
Yeah.
And then the Durham Bulls Baseball Club thought about using that bull as a mascot, and they decided that wouldn't work. That's not the image they wanted. So we were owned at the time by a media conglomerate, Capital Broadcasting, and they had some say in it. And they started out by hiring a high school student before I came on board, and they bought a store-bought suit. And they did fine for a year, and then decided we need more than this.
Well, just to be clear, this is the NAI podcast, What's Up, Interpreters? And we are here talking about interpretation. The reason, Jeff, that we've asked you to come on is because your job, when you did play the role of the mascot, the mascot that you created, was to communicate with an audience. And you had to make a lot of decisions about how that was going to happen. We've already established who you were and your role with the Bulls, but I would invite you also to explain your current role, which is very much about communication as well.
I'm a performer. I'm a mime and a juggler. I was trained as a mime, and I explored mask work, and that's why the Durham Bulls hired me, because we had just closed down our mime troupe in 1993, and the general manager of the Durham Bulls at the time, Peter Hanlon, was an old actor, and I knew him from the stage. So he said, "We really want to beef up this program. Would you be interested?" And I said, "Yes." And the first thing we did was sit down with the stakeholders, the general manager, the owner, and the folks from sales, and decided, what do we want the mascot to be able to do? And that's what really involves your interpreter people, I think, is you have to make those kind of decisions whenever you create a program or a character or some sort of brand idea that you want to explore.
Yeah. Wow. So how long were you the mascot?
I was the mascot physically? For 4 years. I joined in 93 when we were at the old ballpark, the Durham Athletic Park. And then we moved to the new ballpark in 93. Five, and I did two more seasons after that, and so that's when I was there, and I wrote the manual of operations. I helped the people who were creating the costume create it so that it could do what we wanted it to do. For instance, when you have a character, you have to know what you want it to do. Do you want it to be able to sign autographs? Do you want it to be able to run? Do you want it to be, do you want it, you know, how, what do you want it to be able to do? When I was Wooly Bull, since I got to design the costume with the designers, they made it so I could juggle. I juggled baseball bats and baseballs. And so I had to be able to see it. So they had to adjust the way the rig was so that I could juggle and not, you know, and look like I knew what I was doing. Also, I rode a unicycle. So the tail had to be balanced in such a way that it didn't get into the unicycle wheel. So there were these design decisions about the character that impacted what it did.
So I mean, this is all amazing to me, and to hear, you know, the considerations that went into the designing the costume and having them sort of catered to your specific abilities in terms of riding a unicycle and juggling. And I'm curious to know, in the manual of operations, what was the overarching message, personality? What was the goal of your communication as someone, albeit in costume, in front of sometimes probably hundreds, but usually thousands of fans at a baseball game?
In reality, it was more than that. We had to determine how the character worked close up as he walked around and encountered individuals. We had to determine when I performed on the field, I sometimes performed for one section, and that's like proscenium theater. And other times I performed for 5,000 people, and that's arena theater. So whenever we created an event, we had to think in the terms in which it was going to be seen. How is it going to be viewed? And then that would affect the choreography. Like if I'm coming in on a helicopter, right? And the helicopter's going to land, where does it land on the field so that we get the maximum bang for the buck? I mean, it's all the things you have to think about when you present a visual representation. And that's what I was. They wanted the mascot to be a visual representation of the club that they could use not only at games, but outside of games. For instance, in North Carolina at the time, they started a train service from Raleigh to Charlotte. It was called the Crescent. It still is going on. So when they did that, they invited each city along the way to have dignitaries on the train that would get off. So we all went to Raleigh, and Wooly Bull was on the Durham car at the request of the mayor, because he represented by then not just the team, but the city. And an emoji or an icon these days, that's what we were looking for with Wooly Bull when we wanted him to become a symbol of the city, and because he was a symbol for the club.
What were some of the specific differences that you had when in how you would communicate one-on-one with a fan versus how you would communicate to 5,000 from the field?
When I was amongst fans or people in anything, I had to be very gentle. I couldn't be impulsive and moving a lot because I couldn't see as well. And sometimes younger children would just run up and grab the mascot, grab me. And I had to let that happen and then gently pry them off. So when I was one-on-one, I was very much interactive. Wooly's actions were intentionally positive. Mm. He did push, he hugged, he let people come to him. He didn't barge in anywhere. He would come in and be invited. The big thing was we wanted the mascot to be seen as approachable. Mm. So he, person to person. So if he was on a TV show with a host like you right now, sitting in the studio, Wooly we would try to make sure that Wooly was close to the person interviewing. So it was usually a two-shot, not a one-shot and a one-shot, because Wooly's reactions, it's the face doesn't move. Okay, that's one thing we took into account. We had to codify that. When I was in and among people, I'll be crass about this. The reason they wanted a mascot and we designed everything around it at the game was because if a family of four, this is 1993, if a family of four stayed in the ballpark past the fourth inning, we made $36.89 more. And they have done all that research. So everything that I did was designed to keep the families there. So like if I did an autograph session, it was in the fifth inning. And it was in, the autograph session was in the store where they sold all this, all the goods. My autograph booth was in the back of it. So just like in a museum today, you can't get out of a museum without going through the store. I mean, same, we use the same attitude for that. And when Wooly was off-site and at an event, it really had to be choreographed because children literally would glom onto him. They loved him. And that's what we tried to do. We tried to make him an icon. And the third thing was I had in my contract that if we ever met this goal, I got a bonus. The goal was when Wooly Bull merchandise sold more than club merchandise in the club store. And it went 52% my third year with the club, and I got my bonus.
Oh, very good. So that's amazing.
You know, so this is crass commercial stuff. This is for-profit baseball, right? So the decisions we made were for that. And I'll just, you know, I know it sounds crass and commercial, but those were a lot of the things that we took into account.
Sure.
Sure. You really are like the ultimate community outreach.
Right. And we limited that. We didn't, everybody that called and wanted Wooly, it wasn't always a given. We had to evaluate the pros and cons of the mascot being at that event. And because you always want, how did my grandfather used to say it? You always want them to leave the table wanting more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that that's in direct relation to interpreters and their work, right? You always want your visitor to walk away asking more questions, thinking more about, you know, the experience that they just had. What did you want your fans and your baseball audience and community at large really to walk away with after encountering and meeting and hanging out with Wooly Bull?
We wanted them to know that he represented the Durham Bulls, right? First and foremost, we wanted them to know that they had a friend in Wooly Bull, that Wooly was their friend. And in any encounter we had, we tried to stress that physically and the way we set it up and the actions that I would do. That's what we were trying to communicate. This character is your friend, and that was it.
It feels a lot like contemporary social media to me when you have multiple people operating a social media account behind one avatar. You know, so NAI, right. We have our NAI logo, and it doesn't matter who's posting on behalf of NAI. We're trying to establish one voice. When you relinquished the role of Wooly Bull to probably a number of people who have since played that role, you know, they crafted the costume specifically for your talents as a juggler and a unicyclist. What was involved in sort of conveying to your successors, here's who this character is and here's what he represents?
In the manual, it stated that Wooly, his age, we thought of him as about 7 years old. So you're playing, and an actor will understand that this is the character we're playing. That also impacts the way he deals with the world. Seven-year-olds look at the world with awe and wonder, and Wooly was always amazed, and he still is. That when you know, the first guy we hired after me was the former Clemson Tiger. I mean, he was a mascot, and we hired him to be Wooly Bull, and he was a tumbler. So the new suit, when they redid it so that he could tumble better. I mean, he could do the moves in the suit that I had, but I was not a tumbler, you know, and that's, so they had to redo the suit that way. But the raison d'etre, the basis of the character was Wooly is a child and he sees the world with awe and wonder, and he's constantly amazed at what's going on. Whether it's meeting a senator and we're sharing a time at Coach for Kids, right? And all of a sudden Wooly has is being given coats from people, and he would react accordingly. A 7-year-old, think of, you gave 7-year-old 50 coats, they would play with them. So Wooly would play with them, and that was expected.
Wow. I'm curious, because the E stands for education. So how did the organization, how did the character Wooly Bull, how did he put the E in education?
Wooly would be, the Durham Bulls had a program in the schools at the time, and I can't speak for now, in which if a child read a certain number of books, they would get a special Wooly Bull badge. And if the school had enough children that did that, Wooly would come and pin the badges on them. So the school would get a visit from Wooly Bull. Wooly, he would attend 5Ks, and 10Ks usually have a fun mile that goes with them. And they're usually for a good cause, whether whether it's children with cancer or Duke Hospital or anything like that. And Wooly would be there in order to support the education that organization was doing about whatever their topic was. So those were the two main ways that we involved education.
I'm really interested in the fact that your background as a mime played into, you know, what you did as a performer with the baseball team. I'm a Philadelphia Phillies fan. I think that the Philly Fanatic is objectively the best mascot in all of baseball. The guy who played the Philly Fanatic, was his name was Dave Raymond, and
yeah,
he
I
played the
it.
Philly Fanatic for 25 years. I mean, he played him for a long, long time. He was the only one to wear the suit for a long time. And I remember hearing him interviewed, and it was really fascinating to me that he said that he was raised by a single mother who was deaf. And he did a lot of communicating through gesturing and through body language. In interpretation, you know, body language is a big part of the communication that happens, when you're out on a tour or if you're giving a program. What can an interpreter who is allowed to speak to their visitors, what can an interpreter learn about the importance of body language from someone who is a professional mime or who, you know, played a mascot who does not speak at a baseball stadium?
It's funny you should ask that, because that's one of my big criticisms of many mascots now. Stillness on TV or in a presence, when something or somebody is still, they command attention. And what we see a lot today is we see mascots moving a lot in the frame, right, at the cameras all the time, and it's lost. The emotion is lost. That's when you're looking at the different ways that of the media that the mascot encounters. They've got to be versed in, how do you work on TV? You don't move a lot, because you end up out of the frame. And that's one of the things. So that's what I tell anybody that's doing any sort of presentation, is don't be so busy that the people get lost in your movement. And interpreters can learn from that. Whether you're demonstrating a wood stove, you know, making sure that your gestures are clear and simple, rather than, okay, you do this and you do this and you do this. Or if you're on a ship and you're showing how they use the gauges on a ship, you know, to do them one at a time and do it clearly, rather than try to get to all of them. And that's how I would coach anybody that's doing any explanation, especially if it has to be, if it's curatorial.
Well, I see it as almost language translation as well, right? If you are speaking and there's somebody and a translator doing simultaneous translation, you want to speak slowly and you want to speak very intentionally, so that your audience has, you know, the translator has time to catch up with you, and then your audience has time to listen to what you're saying. So I see a correlation just by being an audience person,
yes,
right, in that audience, to have that be a little slower and more intentional.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not pandering, it's clarity.
Yeah.
This is something I don't know. Do museums, events that are curated, like the interpreters that you deal with, do they have costume characters?
Yep, living history reenactors certainly do. Yep, they're in character, and they, you know, I mean, they're very serious about it.
Yeah, they are. And I, you know, I've seen the ones in Williamsburg who are portraying the printer and the, you know, and they are well-versed at their skill and describing it. That's a little different from what I was doing, which was entertaining. That's a difference. That as a costume character, I was entertainment. I wasn't to expound on anything. The only thing that I hated doing was when I would be told somebody was proposing to someone at the ballpark. And that was just because I thought, you know, unless you know the answer, this is not a good place to work this out. But what I did was I had a giant diamond ring. It was about this big. And when I walked through the crowd holding the diamond up, because a lot of people go to baseball games more than once, there's about a 30% of the crowd is there every night, same people. Wow. And so if I started walking through with the diamond ring, everybody knew what was going to happen. And I would walk to the section and go to the guy, and I'd hand him the diamond ring. And he would propose right there. And I can't tell you the number of times where the woman, their lips would be moving, saying, I'm going to nod my head and smile right now, but we're going to talk about this. Right? Just because they were unprepared and they were in front of 5,000 people.
Yeah,
that's awkward.
Yeah.
Awkward is a good word for it. Very awkward. And there were other times when they would just jump up and cry and hug and everything was love. But the couple of times when it wasn't really made me shy.
Yeah. And then you're in the middle of it.
Right. I'm in the middle of this. And I can't talk.
That's where you're happy you can't talk and you invoke the act of stillness.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly.
Well, Jeff, this has been an absolute unexpected pleasure. That what a treat to get to talk to you about the work that you did and continue to do as a mime and a performer. Thank you so much for coming and sharing and relating that to the field of interpretation. I think there's so much crossover here. So it's been a fascinating conversation.
Well, thanks for having me.
Hey, it's been a long, dark off season. I am so glad to see baseball finally getting going again. And I'm going to get to a Durham Bulls game this year. I'm going to be at a Durham Bulls game in May. And so I will keep a special lookout for Wool Education Bull.
Excellent. I hope you enjoy yourself.
And interpreters,
that's what's up.
That's what's up.